B. Collins.
Peter B. Collins, news and comment. It's Monday, September 17th, 2018. A lot of turmoil in Washington, D.C., related to what appears to be delayed confirmation hearings for Brett Kavanaugh. We'll get to that in a moment, but the big news over the past few days has been Paul Manafort's guilty plea to the Robert Mueller investigation. And I've watched quite a bit of television news over the weekend, and I see people celebrating, doing backflips, speculating that this is the linchpin. You pull it out, and the whole thing's going to unravel. However, it's important to note that we haven't seen much Russia in the Russiagate narrative. That is the reason that the Mueller special counsel operation was set up, and that Manafort was targeted with the old charges related to his corrupt practices, making millions of dollars in Ukraine and hiding that money offshore, laundering what came onshore. He certainly is guilty of the charges to which he pled. And it's going to cost him a lot. He clearly will serve some prison time. And he had to cough up a large amounts of his personal fortune, much of it earned illicitly, in my view. And the list of properties that he gave up is pretty impressive. Five homes, including three apartments in New York City, including the one that he bought at Trump Tower as a way to burrow in with the Trump campaign. So Manafort has taken a very serious fall. There's no question about it. But does it relate to the Russiagate narrative? Well, even Mueller's prosecutors in the plea deal acknowledged that it has nothing to do with the overarching Russiagate issues. The central claim is that Russia hacked the DNC, gave that to WikiLeaks, and that Russia meddled in the American election in numerous ways in an effort to support Trump over Clinton. And so far, the people who need to be the most nervous about the Manafort flip are Democrats. Tony Podesta, the brother of John Podesta, who ran the Hillary Clinton for President campaign, and of course is the guy who ran the Center for American Progress. Well, Tony Podesta had to roll up his lobby shop because he was knee-deep in business with Manafort. And when Manafort set up these phony not-profits in Europe to try to get around America's lobbying laws, foreign lobbying laws, Tony Podesta played ball and pretended that this was a legitimate structure that would avoid the requirements to register under FARA, the Foreign Agents Registration Act. And not only Tony Podesta, but the Mercury Public Affairs Group and attorney Gregory Craig. Craig was at Skadden Arps, and they made a lot of money off the Yanukovych government in Ukraine. They appear to be the next dominoes to fall. I don't think Tony Podesta has diddly to give up on Donald Trump. Now, it's certainly possible that Paul Manafort has a lot of dirt on Trump, and I eagerly await the dishing of said dirt. But there isn't even as much as a hint in Mueller's papers and in his legal maneuvers that suggest that we are on the tip of the iceberg known as Russiagate, that soon that whole thing is going to surface and be visible. And for a reality check, we turn to Aaron Matei, the young journalist who did a podcast with me earlier this year. He writes for The Nation and appears on the Real News Network. And if you haven't seen his takedown of James Risen, he didn't actually have to take him down. He just showed him up. The former New York Times investigative journalist, now at The Intercept, basically, rudely ended an interview with Aaron Matei when he asked pointed questions about The Intercept's outing of Reality Winner, the former NSA contractor who is working on 63 months of federal prison time. And Mattei's latest piece, dated September 13 at The Nation, goes into important detail about the limited amount of Russia in Russiagate. He said that the list of convictions, Papadopoulos, Cohen, and Manafort, well, these have not bolstered the case for collusion, as many liberals have hoped. And he goes into detail about the Papadopoulos story, how he got 14 days in prison for lying to investigators, and the Mueller team said that he had substantially hindered their investigators' ability to question Professor Joseph Mifsud when he was in the United States. And Mattei says this is a puzzling claim. Mueller acknowledges that Papadopoulos identified Mifsud to FBI agents voluntarily, though only after, and only, let's see, only after being prompted by a series of specific questions. That's why Papadopoulos hasn't pleaded guilty to lying about Mifsud, but only about the timing of his contacts. And it's important to note that after sentencing, Papadopoulos gave interviews where he said he never talked about Clinton emails with Mifsud or with the Australian ambassador who reported their conversation at a London bar. Now, I don't know if those are completely credible, but I think they're worth noting. And it could be that this was, Papadopoulos was framed by some very clever veteran spies and their allies. Then when it comes to Michael Cohen, Mattei breaks down the curious comments of Lanny Davis, the Democrat who's been serving as the lawyer to the Republican Cohen, and the innuendo about whether he had dirt to give to Mueller. In specific, did Trump know about the Trump Tower meeting with the Russians beforehand? And claims by Lanny Davis that Fed anonymous stories, stories that were anonymously sourced, and we now know that Lanny Davis was that source, the Washington Post, the New York Post, and CNN got burned by him. And CNN, according to Mattei, has yet to explain it or even to apologize. Davis has also walked back claims that Michael Cohen might have been in Prague. No, he was never, ever in Prague, and that is key to some of the allegations that surfaced earlier. But when it comes to Manafort, the critical thing that Aaron Mattei points out is that the testimony of his former colleague, Rick Gates, makes it very clear that despite the innuendo in American media that's often just treated as fact, that Manafort's work for Yanukovych was not pro-Russia. Manafort was actively trying to get Yanukovych to tilt toward Europe, toward NATO. That was not an errand of the Kremlin. And the commentary in the plea deal, let me read here a footnote from the Nation article. The exhibits attached to Mueller's new superseding indictment corroborate Mattei's argument that contrary to the predominant narrative, Manafort actually pursued a pro-West, anti-Russia agenda in Ukraine. In one email, Manafort proposes to reinforce the key geopolitical messaging of how Europe and the U.S. should not risk losing Ukraine to Russia. Now, this is a minor detail, but it becomes major because of the way it has been magnified. And it is a central error in the predominant Russiagate narrative. Now to Brett Kavanaugh and the late hit delivered by California Senior Senator Dianne Feinstein. The letter that was secret last week is now in the wide open. The secret accuser of Brett Kavanaugh is now known. Her name is Christine Blasey Ford. She's 51 years old. She is a doctor of psychology at Palo Alto University here in California. And she went to school in suburban Washington, D.C., and says that while they were in high school, although she doesn't know the date, she can't even quite remember what year it was, She said there was this scene where a drunken Kavanaugh tried to climb on her and, she says, attempted rape. And in one description, she says that she worried that he might kill her. Now, I respect her story, and I respect her reaction to it. But I think of it in terms of, and she has said, by the way, that she will appear before the Senate Judiciary Committee and face the senators for questions. The cross-examination from the Republicans will be blistering. And when they try to pin her down about when it happened, where it happened, who was there, unless she is very, very compelling and highly composed, she may be shredded by the Republicans. And I think the Democrats are vulnerable to charges that Dianne Feinstein got this letter that was then anonymous from Ms. Ford at the end of July. And she waited until the hearings were over to reference them in any way, shape, or form. Now, what's fascinating is to see a president of the United States defend his Supreme Court nominee from allegations of sexual misbehavior, even if they happened 35 years ago. He, of course, is the least credible person in the United States to try to, you know, validate the denials of his Supreme Court nominee. And Kellyanne Conway, playing the good cop, says, this woman should not be insulted. She should not be ignored. She should be heard. And so Trump goes public with a statement that he believes that she should be heard. He's acting as if he's kind of unconcerned about a delay in the hearings and perhaps a need to withdraw the nomination. So this is a very messy scene. And as I referenced on Friday, I watched in horror as Clarence Thomas was not rejected by the Judiciary Committee because he played the race card. And then the Democrats played the Anita Hill card. And he was able to react to that in a way that pushed the Democrats back and allowed him to get confirmed by, I think, 2 votes. But he still sits on the Supreme Court for the rest of his life. And this is the way Kavanaugh, I'm sure, intends to play this. Now let's turn to the politics of it. Because, as you know, there are 2 critical issues. To me, the most significant is keeping the Democrats united in opposition to Brett Kavanaugh. Well, this episode may accomplish that. Because the most spineless members of the Democratic Senate caucus, Donnelly of Indiana, Heitkamp, North Dakota, Manchin, West Virginia, they are using this to say that they want hearings, they want Kavanaugh to face his accuser, and they expect delays as a result. Susan Collins of Maine, one of the uncommitted Republicans, said that Ford and Judge Kavanaugh should both testify under oath before the Judiciary Committee. So, as I speak, I think that minds are being changed and plans are being shifted in Washington. But here is a fair comment from Susan Collins, who, by the way, is no relation to yours truly. Quote, what is puzzling to me is the Democrats, by not bringing this out earlier, after having had this information for more than 6 weeks, have managed to cast a cloud of doubt on both the professor and the judge. If they believe Professor Ford, why didn't they surface this information earlier so that he could be questioned about it? Referring to Kavanaugh. And if they didn't believe her and chose to withhold the information, why did they decide at the 11th hour to release it? It's really not fair to either of them the way it was handled. Then there's Patty Murray, the Democrat of Washington. She says, I was motivated to run for the Senate after watching the truly awful way Anita Hill was treated by an all-male Judiciary Committee, interrogating her about the sexual harassment she endured at the hands of Clarence Thomas. So this, in fact, could change the trajectory of these Kavanaugh hearings. And given that the Democrats did a pretty good job of getting on the record the dissembling of Judge Kavanaugh over critical matters about his White House duties, his connection to torture, to certain judicial nominations that he's tried to distance himself from. And then there's his validating witness, Kavanaugh's friend, who apparently was there for the incident that Ms. Ford has related. His name is Mark Judge. Well, Mark Judge flatly says, "It never happened. I never saw anything like what was described." Further, he said, "It doesn't match Kavanaugh. It's not who he is." But Ford has written novels based on his high school escapades. And if that gets entered into the record at the Senate Judiciary Committee, I'm not sure where it will go. And here's an interesting comment from the Washington Post's Margaret Sullivan. She was formerly the New York Times public editor, and I do give her credit for caring about journalism and offering smart commentary. And she makes a critical point in her op-ed today that the clock is not running out. There is no clock. And while, yes, this is late in the process, I stand by my point that Feinstein should have found a way to bring this up earlier. Sullivan points out there is no deadline. The Senate sets the schedule here, and while there is a schedule in place to rush this nomination to confirmation, that doesn't have to stand. So it's very fluid, and it's going to be fascinating to see how this plays out. I give the Democrats credit for not giving up, but this does seem to be a pretty slimy way to try to block this confirmation. Also on the Me Too page, some of this gets a little bit personal and weird, but Asia Argento on Twitter today is threatening legal action against Rose McGowan. Now, as you know, these are two women who surfaced as key accusers of Harvey Weinstein. Asia Argento, in addition, was the last girlfriend of Anthony Bourdain. And I watched one of his episodes, CNN's been replaying some of them, on television last night. So they are in a battle because Asia Argento has said that she's being blackmailed by Jimmy Bennett. And Jimmy Bennett, a child actor who she's known since he was seven or something like that, Jimmy Bennett claims that she sexually assaulted him in a California hotel room in 2013. Now, I'm not in any position to judge any of these people. But this is the messy aftermath of the lack of process in the Me Too movement. And we're starting to see some of the blowback. So the tweet reads, "Dear Rose McGowan, it is with genuine regret that I am giving you 24 hours to retract and apologize for the horrendous lies made against me in your statement of August 27. If you fail to address this libel, I will have no option other than to take immediate action." And then we see the publication of McGowan's statement in which she talks about her And I have a little discomfort with this, I'll just be honest with you. She is in a relationship with a person named Rain Dove. And Rain Dove represents as gender-free. And Rain Dove is referred to as they or as a being in this lengthy message. And it's weird. That's all I can tell you. And so this is now playing out in public with threats of legal action, with Jimmy Bennett's feelings dangling, and nobody appears to have much interest in that. And you have Argento battling with Rain Dove and its, you're not allowed to say it, their partner, McGowan. I don't know where this one leads. Also on the Me Too page today, Soon-Yi Previn has published a lengthy op-ed defending her relationship with Woody Allen and deploring the way his work has essentially been blacklisted. His latest movie was blocked from distribution by the movie chains, which refused to pick it up. Every day I pause for a second to thank the people who support my work here at the Peter B. Collins Podcast with your subscriptions. Great people like Ford Green, Mark Lewis, Gunnar Gunderson, who's over in the Middle East, and Joe Carson in Knoxville, Tennessee. I enjoy an audience all around the world, and it's really a pleasure for me every day to offer my news and comments, to share my in-depth interviews with you. But I don't make much money doing this, and we cover our expenses. I'd love to see a good income here so I could justify this on a financial basis. So if you are so moved, and if you value the work that I do here on a daily basis, please come on over to peterbcollins.com. There's a menu tab. You click on it, then click on Become a Subscriber. You land on the sign-up page. It's easy to choose the PayPal system there, $5, $10, $20 a month. Our $50 annual subscription earns you a new bonus gift, a CD of rock and roll music from John Dist. I'd love to send you one. And, of course, you can always communicate with me in the U.S. mail. My address is Box 150, 660, San Rafael, California, 94915. Here's another guy named Collins, no relation to yours truly, the New York Republican Chris Collins, who has been indicted on insider trading charges and is spending a lot of time with his lawyers, had said that he won't run for re-election. But now it appears in a political gamesmanship, he's going to leave his name on the ballot because lawyers said that under New York's complex election laws, the attempt to remove him would most likely face a Democratic lawsuit and would muddle the election for his replacement. I'm not sure if those are his real motives, but I think a lot of Republicans feel that, you know, you don't have to do Al Franken's move. You don't have to be honorable. If you get caught, you just fight it out. Oh, like Duncan Hunter here in California. Mike Bloomberg was here in San Francisco for Jerry Brown's International Climate Summit last week, and he's been spreading rumors about himself that he is considering a campaign for president in 2020. And Mike, let me just suggest that you give it a rest. I'm grateful that you're pumping $80 million into Democratic campaigns to try to flip control of the House this year. And you are also rhetorically attacking your former colleagues in the Republican Party. Let's remember that Bloomberg was a Republican before he became an independent. And the idea that he would run as a Democrat, I think, is pretty offensive to many sectors of the Democratic Party. And, of course, he still defends the stop-and-frisk law that occurred in his three terms as mayor of New York. He also attacks Elizabeth Warren's efforts to regulate the banks and to hold the 1% accountable. So I think, Mike, you've done great work on gun control and on battling big soda, but be satisfied with that. And please, don't try to run for president as a Democrat. And I offer the same message to Joe Biden and John Kerry and Hillary Rodham Clinton. There are a lot of people who think that we should, reach back to the past to find a candidate for the future. And I have to say that, to be fair, Bernie Sanders must prove once again that he is viable as a candidate for president in 2020. All of these people are getting old, and I think that it's really time for a new generation of Democratic leaders. And speaking of John Kerry, he's making the rounds. He was here for the climate summit. He did Bill Maher's show on Friday night, and he's promoting a book about his life. And in the book, he admits that he has had several meetings with the foreign minister of Iran since he left office. Three or four times, he has sat down with Javad Zarif. This has drawn blistering attacks from Trump and from the current Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, who say that Kerry has been actively undermining U.S. policy. Now, their anxiety about this is quite misplaced, because you've got Henry Kissinger, and on the Democratic side, Madeleine Albright, trotting the globe on a daily basis, not only meeting with various people who have interests before our government, including some adversaries of the Trump administration, but they charge for it. Kissinger and Albright are paid international advisors and lobbyists. I don't know if they claim under the Foreign Registration Act to be lobbyists, but let's not pretend otherwise. Today, I am releasing a powerful in-depth interview to my subscribers at peterbcollins.com. There is a brilliant and unusual new book out called Spaces of Disappearance, The Architecture of Extraordinary Rendition. And this book takes a very unique perspective on those issues. It's written by Jordan Carver, a guy with multiple degrees who's currently working on a doctorate at NYU. And in our conversation, we had a wide-ranging discussion about the issues of detention, rendition, torture, Guantanamo, the Obama administration's politics. And here's a quick excerpt from my interview where Jordan Carver talks about his perspective on these spaces, the architecture, the buildings, the places where these grisly acts take place.
Well, I can think of Guantanamo Bay and think of the black sites, the network of black sites, the secret prisons, as a spatial project. When I say that, I mean that the government, the Bush administration, understood law and they understood domestic sovereignty as interconnected. And they needed a way to break the two apart. And they needed a way to actually enact the policies that they needed. And so to do that, they had to think about space in a very complex way. My training as an architect and a spatial thinker allowed me to approach the question of Guantanamo Bay, the question of interrogation, and the question of these spaces in a spatial register.
That's author Jordan Carver. I invite you to listen to the full interview available later today at peterbcollins.com and most of our outlets. There's a powerful op-ed in The Guardian today written by the ACLU's Brett Max Kaufman. And with a name Brett and a surname that begins with a K, I guess he uses his middle name to try to distinguish himself from Brett Kavanaugh. But this is a strong piece blaming President Obama for not doing enough to curtail America's drones. And he accurately talks about how near the end of his term, after nearly 500 drone strikes that killed more than 3,000 people, Obama used executive orders to moderately limit the CIA's role in conducting lethal drone strikes abroad, particularly in areas where we don't have any declaration of war or any legitimate reason to be there. The op-ed notes that Obama's stymied Supreme Court nominee, Judge Merrick Garland, called official secrecy the fiction of deniability in a case concerning drone transparency and the CIA. And that's one of the things I talked with Jordan Carver about, too. The things that we know are right before our eyes that are treated as secret by our government. And the ACLU attorney appropriately slams John Brennan, who ramped up the use of drones for targeted killings, effectively institutionalizing them, channeling what had been mostly ad hoc decisions about who to kill and where into a systematized process complete with the Orwellian nomenclature like disposition matrix for kill list. And he says all of Obama's changes were in a critical way fundamentally deficient because all of them were imposed through executive orders. They would do little to bind his successors. Lo and behold, Trump promptly loosened the killing rules and exempted certain geographic regions from their coverage. And the media has stopped reporting, for the most part, on the use of America's drones across the globe. Another of the consequences of 9/11 and the changes that it enabled include changes to the law in 2008. Remember when Obama said he was against extending the FISA law, and then after he secured the nomination, he flipped and voted for it? Well, in that modification of the law, they included language allowing procedures for processing FISA applications targeting known media entities or known members of the media. This enables the government to go to the FISA court and seek a warrant to provide surveillance on those who, I believe, are fully protected by the First Amendment. And a staff attorney with the Knight Institute, Ramya Krishnan, says there's a lack of clarity on the circumstances when the government might consider a journalist an agent of a foreign power. And what if they're just interviewing an agent of a foreign power? Because that's their job. Well, this is a murky situation and another set of affairs put into motion by many of my listeners' favorite modern president, Barack Obama. And finally, we go south to the Mexican border, where a Border Patrol agent has reportedly confessed to committing four murders after his fifth target escaped his custody and alerted authorities. The agent is Juan David Ortiz. He was taken into custody on Saturday morning after a woman who claimed she'd been abducted escaped half-clothed and sought help at a gas station in Laredo, Texas. And this is not the first case. It appears that most of his victims were working prostitutes, and maybe this was some kind of a biblical justice act on his part. But, in April, authorities in Laredo arrested a supervisor of the Border Patrol, whose name is Anthony Aviles, charged him with killing a woman with whom he was romantically involved and her one-year-old son. It's been just 2 years since a senior Border Patrol stationed near Del Rio was taken into custody, charged with distributing child porn and attempting to entice a minor to engage in sexual activity. Back in 2014, a Border Patrol agent in Texas kidnapped, attacked, and sexually assaulted three undocumented immigrants. What's very clear here, beyond the failings of these individuals, is that our Border Patrol agents are very poorly vetted and poorly trained. And finally today, Ryan Devereaux reporting in a good piece at The Intercept that the group of Christian volunteers who patrol the border, looking to assist those who are in distress, who might be dying as they attempt to cross the desert, they have become the targets of federal agents. And the Justice Department is attempting to suppress a series of text messages, perhaps some tweets, between U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service employees and Border Patrol agents, in which they refer to these volunteers as bean droppers, and they celebrate the idea of cracking down and shutting them down. And this just shows the bankrupt nature of our efforts to control our border. Because as I've said many times, we have every right as a nation to control that border. But it doesn't devolve to this attitude that these are people who are subhuman, that they don't have fundamental human rights, that we are superior to them. And the idea that they're targeting Scott Warren, an instructor at Arizona State University, because he provided two undocumented men with food, water, and a place to sleep for 3 days. He faces 20 years in prison if convicted. This is a really dark era for the United States. And while it's easy to blame Trump, the Republican machine, and they earn a lot of that, we have a fundamental breakdown of humanness. And I'm not sure there's a remedy. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast. You're free to share this far and wide. You'll find it on YouTube, and I remain Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.